no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a off.
He's supposed to be an interview.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging, mostly because there's no grass on the golf course, but there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I have high hopes for the swag bag.
Trap. When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trashy.
What's happening, folks? Alex Dixon, Beltway Golfer. Welcome. Very first episode, podcast, YouTube series. For those listening on a podcast, make sure to check out the YouTube channel. There's going to be bonus footage there that won't be a part of the podcast. So be sure to check that out. Super excited to finally launch this. The premise of the show is real straightforward. I'm going to be having conversations with lots of super interesting folks that are connected to the golf industry and the golf world, or just share a love and passion for the game of golf around the DC area and the greater DMV. Just kind of pumped to get this off the ground and get going, and hope you guys will bear with me. This is a new muscle for me. And so there's going to be some kinks, some hiccups. Hopefully over time the production value will go up. My conversation and interviewing skills hopefully will improve, and we'll see where it leads. But we'll jump off. Our very first guest for first episode here is Mike McCartan of Mike McCartan Golf Design, and he is one of the co-founders of the nonprofit National Links Trust, who recently just put in a bid to operate and lead kind of the project for the three public golf courses on National Park Service land in Washington, D.C., East Potomac Park, Rock Creek Park, and Langston. We were super excited to meet him up at Rock Creek Park Golf Course, walk around the grounds, hear a bit more about their plans and the bid and their vision, and then sit down and talk with him and learn more about what they potentially have in store, not just at Rock Creek Park, but also at East Potomac Park and Langston Golf Course. And also hear about some of his other projects, like his recent role in the renovation over at Washington Golf and Country Club, and his project, a local nine-holer that so many people love around here, the Schoolhouse Nine out in Sperryville, Virginia. It was a great conversation. It was great to really sit down and learn more about him and get to know him better. So check it out. Hope you enjoy it. All right. Mike McCartan. How's it going?
Good. It's great.
Welcome to Beltway Golfer.
Yeah.
Thanks for being part of the experiment.
I'm excited. You know, I hope you work through your kinks. Whatever.
Yeah, there's some kinks. There'll be some kinks here. We're out here at Rock Creek Golf Course in Northwest Washington, D.C. One of the three courses inside the city on National Park Service land that there's a lot of talk around right now because of this RFP by the NPS.
Yeah.
So why don't we start there a little bit, and then we'll kind of backtrack, but tell us a little bit about where everything stands today.
Sure. We submitted our proposal for the operation of the three golf courses back at the end of February, and we were never given an exact timeline about when a decision would come, but my impression was always right about now would be an announcement. And when I reached out just to ask about timeline from the Park Service recently, they said they'd like to announce in the next couple weeks. That doesn't necessarily mean they will, but hopefully sure. We'll hear soon.
There have been timelines in the past that have come and gone.
Right.
But it seems like this, I mean, now we've got the RFP, all the bids have been submitted. We don't, based on our, we just walked a good portion of Rock Creek, Mike and I. So we've had a little bit of conversation already, but there's only one other bid that you definitely know about.
Yep.
But there may be more.
Yeah, I mean, there's no requirement to say that you're bidding, so it could be that there's other people out there, but generally, I think you want to show a presence in the community and, you know, at least a knowledge of what you're bidding on publicly, so sure. I would be surprised if there are a lot more than the two.
Sure. And why don't we give everyone just kind of a high level of what the RFP is for. Mike has already done a couple interviews on another podcast called The Fried Egg with Andy Johnson, which I certainly encourage everybody to listen to. Easily searchable Fried Egg. Just search Mike McCartan. I listened to both of them a couple times in preparation for this, where he talks a little bit about the RFP. But go on, why don't we give us just kind of a high level of what is the RFP?
Sure. It's for a long-term lease for the three Washington, D.C. golf courses that are controlled by the National Park Service. And, you know, there's some variables that give the bidders, you know, some flexibility in terms of what they want to propose. There's no strict lease term, so we proposed 50 years.
That was your proposal?
Our proposal.
Oh, I thought that was theirs. I didn't realize that.
So, but you can propose up to a 60-year lease, but you can also propose less. So that's one element of what the Park Service will be weighing. The other would be, you know, what is the proposal for work to do on the courses? What's the benefit that users of the site will get by, you know, choosing one lessee or another? And then the last component would be, what's the rent you're paying to the Park Service for doing it?
And this RFP is a huge change from the way that the National Park Service has operated these three golf courses in Washington, D.C. from the past, because of this shorter term concessionaire contracts. Yep. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. This is actually one of the first scenarios that fits a model that the Park Service is trying to implement more widely. But the basic idea is that traditionally concessioners have been awarded contracts that are relatively short term, you know, all across the Park Service, but with the golf courses in DC being no exception, with a 7 to 10 year contract length for a concessioner. It doesn't incentivize a concessioner to make a large capital investment when the time frame is that short. That's kind of number one. Number two, though, is that even if somebody wanted to make a large capital investment in their concession, relatively recent legislation, you know, that governs the Park Service makes it impossible to do it without the Park Service paying for it. The reason being, there was a long time from when the concessions system started where it was up to the concessioner to determine what investments they wanted to make in their property. But sure. At the end of their concessions contract, the next concessioner would have to pay the previous concessioner for all of the improvements that they made. And what ended up happening was that the concessioners got entrenched in their positions because no one wanted to pay them for what they had invested.
So they ended up being the same concessioner for a long time.
And I don't know, I think it might have actually been the Park Service had to pay back the old concessioner. And so instead of having to do that, the concessioners just stayed and stayed and stayed and got more and more entrenched. And there was no turnover. And
had very little incentive to really do any significant improvement.
And then once you've done that, you've kind of entrenched yourself, then you don't need to do anything.
Sure.
Because they're not going to kick you out when they owe a lot of money, you know, should they want to switch. Yeah. So then a law was put in place that said that system is untenable. If we're going to make capital improvements, the Park Service pays for it, period. But that meant, given, you know, all of the funding issues that are inherent to any government-related thing, that a lot less capital investment was being made than should have been. And so now there's a recognition that maybe a long-term lease is the better approach, where you give a lessee a opportunity to make some investments and realize a return on them over a long period of time.
Sure. And so within this RFP process, you and a partner of yours, Will Smith,
yep,
have started a nonprofit called National Links Trust.
Yep.
So this is where you come in.
Sure.
So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, Will and I are both DC natives. And we, I grew up playing at East Potomac. It's where I learned to play golf. It's a special place for me. I know that story is something that's really common in the area, and if you're thinking about kind of the types of places that really introduce the most people to the game, you know, East Potomac, Rock Creek, and Langston have to be at the top. They're like the prime examples of places that are really like the gateway to golf for the most number of people. They're close to large population centers, you know, and really welcoming and accessible.
And very historically
and
significant.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of an icing on the cake. I mean, like, that's unique to these courses here, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be. I mean, the general components, you know, location and affordability are sure. Probably the most important things. And then, you know, when you get into it, well, the, like, what makes the DC courses even more special is the, you know, the circumstances around which they were founded and the, you know, the golf architects and kind of events that occurred over time at each site, you know, are pretty amazing to think about. And so, like, getting it back to the original question, when, you know, Will and I are both have a history in the golf industry, recognize a lot of the things that we've been involved with. Like, I've worked for Tom Doak, like, worked on a lot of great golf courses, but it really is about, you know, the things that are most special to me are the things that people can actually see and play. And a lot of the places you end up working on, you know, for new golf courses tend to be places that are relatively private and inaccessible. So, sure. You know, the combination of all of this is that, like, in our backyards, places that we really care about, have this great history and an opportunity to, you know, kind of recapture what's been lost over time and show it off. And that's where the National Links Trust came from.
Love it. And so I got a bunch more questions about National Links Trust, about where the RFP stands, about, you know, plans for all three courses in the future. Let's back up a little bit just to kind of talk briefly about your bona fides. So you've been into golf course design and architecture from a kid, since you were a kid, right?
Yeah. I know this is, it's got to be really weird to, you know, for to hear about, but I mean, it's not that unusual, I guess, but.
And you're a DC native.
Yeah. I grew up in Arlington, Virginia. So not to, you know.
DC area.
DC area.
DMV.
And when I first started playing it, so this is the way I describe it. I can't guarantee that this is exactly how it happened, but started playing at East Potomac. It's extremely flat, at the very least. There's some leftover cool stuff, but mostly all of the cool Walter Travis stuff that was originally designed has been bulldozed out of existence, and it's pretty basic. So, like, when you start there, the white course and the blue course and the red course at East Potomac, you're starting from a relatively blank slate of what a golf course is. It's, like, fairly close to the most basic form. It's a great place. Like, the place is great, but the golf course, you know, is relatively basic. So then anytime I went and played someplace new, you're kind of adding elements of, you know, just topography. Like, how does a golf course go over topography? Sure. Like, bunkers and hazards and green contour. And for whatever reason, that really sparked, you know, an interest for me. And yeah, from I probably started playing when I was 10. And by the time I was 12, I had all of the golf architecture books that were in existence at the time.
And so fast forwarding a little bit through college and then on to, you got a master's at University of Georgia.
Yep.
In
landscape architecture.
Landscape architecture. And your master's thesis is easily findable online. I've read bits and pieces of it over the years, many times. It's long. It's a 182 page PDF.
Yeah.
I'd be lying if I said I read the entire thing. But it's impressive. It is an exhaustive, and the master's thesis is about the history of East Potomac golf course and what could be.
Yeah.
And comparing it to some very, you know, well-known, architecturally significant golf courses around the world.
Yeah. So the first thing is, when I finished that, I figured that girlfriend at the time, you know, and my dad, and the people on my thesis committee would be the only people to ever read that thing. I was you know, it's shocking to me that anyone has read that and come to me and said, oh, you know, I did that. It's crazy. But yeah, so it's about East. Well, what I first thought was kind of along the lines of kind of origin story getting into golf architecture is that, okay, this is East Potomac is a place where you can say, what do I think is important about, you know, golf that's accessible to anyone? What should a course, you know, that will take people who are like total beginners all the way through, you know, very good golfers, what can make a place like that work in a way that actually provides a lot of architectural interest? I mean, it works right now. It's open and there's not a lot of contour and people get around fast and it's in a great and beautiful location. So like, it's totally functional, but like, how can you add something that's really interesting architecturally to that and make it work so that like, it's still affordable. It's not like you're adding cost just by, you know, for maintenance, sure. But it still allows everybody to get around. So that was the general idea of the thesis. I had really no idea going into that the course had the history that it had. And so when I started digging into it, I realized that like the angle I was taking needed to change and be more about what was there, how does it relate to some of the great courses in history, and how can you bring something like that back to life? And then how does that reflect those principles of what makes a great municipal or publicly accessible course?
When you were writing that thesis at how old?
Like 25.
Like 25.
Or 28.
28, so many years ago. Yeah. Was this day, this RFP that you're now a part of, was that, were you thinking about that?
No, not at all. I was thinking about writing something that got my ideas on paper about public, accessible, and affordable golf.
But that thesis has really laid the groundwork for, is that fair to say, for kind of the...
Yeah, I mean,
what
I think...
What the National Links Trust is all about.
I think so, because, I mean... For the National Links Trust, it's about making sure there is great, affordable public golf. Because that's the, you know, it shouldn't be the realm of private golf courses or extremely expensive. I mean, Bandon and Streamsong and, you know, great golf courses like that are also public might as well be private for a lot of people because they're hard to get to and they're super expensive. So.
Sure. You know, I wrote down your, I don't know if this is, you call this the mission statement of the National, but yeah. Promoting and protecting affordability, accessibility, and engaging golf course architecture at municipal golf courses throughout the United States.
And so the way you tie that back, especially to East Potomac and where we came from when we were thinking about starting the National Links Trust was there's been a lot of talk over a lot of time about taking East Potomac or Langston and making it into a championship course where they might host a tournament and therefore you could charge, you know, hundreds of dollars for a round of golf at one of those places. And that's always struck me as the wrong idea. I mean, it's entirely possible, right? They're great locations. And if you built a good enough golf course, regardless of whether you have a tournament, you could build something where you charge people a lot of money because, I mean, there's a lot of people in close proximity and they're great locations. But to me, the courses have always functioned as like the gateway to golf for beginners through, you know, people who just don't have access to places that are, you know, more expensive or private. And we have to keep that function. Otherwise, the ability to access golf goes away. And these are the places that, because of their location and because of their histories, need to continue to be, you know, easily accessible and affordable for everybody. And if we can add great golf architecture to that, I think we've hit the holy grail.
Absolutely. Especially at a time where we are losing public golf courses at a pretty fast rate near urban centers.
Absolutely.
Because as urban sprawl, obviously, continues and the property values just keep skyrocketing, suddenly an 18-hole golf course is worth a lot more as a subdivision.
Totally.
So keeping these accessible. So your first, so you went to work for Tom Doak, Renaissance Golf, probably worked on, I've heard you talk about work some pretty special projects, but your first solo project is, am I right, the hat you're wearing right now?
Yeah.
For those who are watching video, yep. Schoolhouse 9, Sperryville, right. Virginia.
Yes.
You talk a lot about that on the fried egg, and I want to focus more today about, Rock Creek and DC, but tell us just a little bit about Schoolhouse 9.
Schoolhouse 9 is a 9-hole par 3 course in Sperryville, Virginia, which is about an hour and a half from DC, right at the foot of the Shenandoah Mountains. And just a really beautiful place and really cool small town. And the owner, Cliff Miller, approached Tom Doak about building a par 3 course for him there. And Tom, at the time, was really busy in a lot of different places and knows that I live in DC and that I would certainly be interested in something like that. So got me and Cliff together. And Cliff is a really kind of special guy who realized that he, by building a par 3 course, there are a lot of ways you could do it. But basically his approach was, let's make it as affordable to maintain as possible so that we don't need to be, crowded all the time in order to make the business work, and that we can also kind of show in a county that's pretty conservative in terms of the types that it's actually probably more liberal a place than you might expect. But they're very conservative about the types of development that they allow there. And a golf course is definitely not on the list of things that they were all that interested in seeing happen. But Cliff realized, and I think it's the right, if a golf course should really reflect its location, that that something like the Schoolhouse 9 was the right approach, where really minimal irrigation, only irrigating the greens. The golf course is gonna change with the seasons. It actually kind of reflects, the course is built in like a meadow that used to be grazed by, farm animals. It reflects that aesthetic.
All par threes. I think the first time I played it in about 35 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Pay at the bar.
I mean, it's just the coolest in that it's as minimal an operation as you can get, and hopefully it does the same thing we're talking about here. It's like the golf course architecture is interesting, so like the conditions don't need to be perfect for you to feel like you're experiencing something cool.
Yeah. And for anybody that hasn't been there or hasn't been to Sperryville, it's cool. You're right next to, I guess, the middle central entrance to the Shenandoah National Park.
Yep.
I forget what it's called, but Sperryville itself is a cool little small town. It's got a brewery.
Yeah.
It's got a distillery.
Yeah.
Some really cool antique stores.
Great pizza shop.
And then there's an antique arcade connected to the golf course and the bar.
It's the old schoolhouse for Sperryville. It was an antique shop for a long time. Now, Rappahannock Community College and a few other businesses operate on kind of the upper levels, but the bottom level is an arcade and a restaurant and bar, and that's like basically the clubhouse for the golf course.
Got it. Yeah, no, I love it. I'm actually going to be down there, I think, the next couple weekends.
Nice.
So we're out here. Eddie, folks watching the video, we started out in the shade. We're slowly getting into the sun here. We got gnats. We're right past what used to be the 18th green. So and this is the opening day of Rock Creek after being shut down for COVID-19, for coronavirus.
Yep.
This is Friday, June 5th.
Yeah.
So there's golfers out here. It's early morning. They just reopened, and the course closes down for essentially the winter. They closed in early December.
Yeah, I don't know if that's all the time, but I do think that they're kind of sensitive to the amount of play that Rock Creek gets. Yeah. I think having seen the financials as part of the RFP process, there are times of the year where it doesn't make sense for the course to be open because of the lack of play and the expense to maintain it. So.
Sure. So before we kind of dive back into Rock Creek and the RFP, one of the other local projects you just finished was at the historic Inside the Beltway Washington Golf and Country Club, which just went through a pretty significant renovation.
Yep.
What was your role in that project? They just reopened.
I grew up, that was my high school's home course. So it's the type of place where you play it enough, you start thinking, especially for somebody interested in architecture, start thinking about, well, what would you do to make the course better? You know, and that was before I really knew a lot of the history of what happened to the course. But there was a time in 2013 or 2014 when the club was considering whether to replace the cart paths as a, you know, kind of, if we're going to replace the cart paths, then that's the time to do other construction work that you might want to do. And, you know, should we be considering doing anything like that? And so I've brought, you know, working with Tom Doak, you know, the club engaged for a master plan. And so we put together a master plan that, you know, kind of said, here's where the course is now. This is what Flynn designed back in the day. This is what we think is the best way forward for the club. And that process has resulted in the work that just was completed.
And just in case any folks that aren't familiar with Tom Doak, he's one of, if not the premier golf course architect designer that we have today. So Washington Golf Country Club just reopened. So we're back here. We're here at Rock Creek. You know, I feel like we could do one of these episodes or one of these conversations for each of the three courses. We just walked a good part of the course and the property, and Mike shared with me the vision and what's a part of the proposal specifically for Rock Creek. Why don't you go into that a little bit, sure, as far as just what you talked about on the 239s and everything?
So the basic idea is, right now we have 18 holes.
This is Rock Creek we're talking about.
Rock Creek right now, there are 18 holes, 9 of which are closed. And those 18 holes are kind of connected in the past to an original 18-hole design by William Flynn, of which a lot has changed over time because of some expansion to roads and such in Rock Creek Park. And so those changes have kind of condensed the course into something that's, you know, it's somewhere between a full-length course and kind of an executive course. There are a lot of par threes within the 18. And so our thought was basically, like, how can we take the design heritage from William Flynn, bring back as much of that as possible, but still also provide golf for people in a world where, like, everybody's kind of pressed for time, like things that you can do in 2 hours or less. Part of that is just the nature of the site not being big enough for, you know, the recapture of Flynn's design. And so what do you do in that scenario? But the basic idea that we have now is 9 full-length original Flynn holes, or as much of that as we can get, 9-hole par 3 course, and then a driving range. And that would kind of hit on the things that matter about the property, its history, and the reality of golf today.
And so with that, you get a little bit for everyone.
Yeah.
You get a full-length 9-hole course.
Yep.
You said about 3,300 yards.
Yep.
Recapturing the original design of the place by William Flynn.
Yep.
William Flynn was a well-known golf course architect from the golden age of golf in the 1920s, I think it was built.
Yeah.
But then you also get a par 3 course.
Yep.
For someone that's looked for something a little shorter, and you get a driving range. And,
yep,
and we're Rock Creek, for those who don't know, Rock Creek, where we're located, I mean, we are in prime commute area. We're right in Rock Creek Park, in between 16th Street on the east side and,
yep,
Connecticut Avenue to the west.
Yep.
People coming home, driving home from Capitol Hill or downtown, you know, hit the driving range, hit you know, play a quick 9 on the
exactly
par 3 course, what,
yep,
have you. I think it's, I'm excited to see the proposal. So we got, there's one of the maintenance guys driving by right now. I'd love to kind of do this as well at East Potomac and Langston. Can you talk a little bit about your proposals there? So East Potomac Park, you've obviously gone into extensive detail in,
yeah,
both the thesis on Andy's podcast about East Potomac specifically, but it was well known to be originally a reversible 18,
yeah,
by Walter Travis. And Tom Doak, who we've also mentioned, you know, several times already, he's worked for, is recently, was it Forest Dunes in Michigan?
Yeah, the loop at Forest Dunes.
Which is a reversible golf course. Yes. Is that the only one today in the United States?
No, there's another one called Sylvia's Valley Ranch in Oregon, rural Oregon.
I didn't realize that was, I've heard of Sylvia's Valley. I didn't realize that was reversible.
They actually, you know, it's like with these ideas that percolate for a long time, like all of a sudden they pop up all at once.
Sure.
Both of those courses opened at about the same time.
So I have to ask, is that part of the proposal?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So our proposal is, originally Walter Travis designed 18 holes, what's now the blue course, basically, and that was reversible. Then another 9 holes by William Flynn were added at East Potomac. That was also reversible. And then at various points, there were more holes than that in different configurations out on the course. But the blue course, the Travis course, has always been there and in about the same spot. The white course, the Flynn course, has always been there in about the same spot. So our proposal is to recapture the Walter Travis course, the blue course, and in its reversibility and everything, like truly a historic preservation project.
That's exciting. And so like the functionality of that for the average golfer. So 18 holes reversible.
Yes.
Is it one day you're going one Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you're going this way, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, you're going the opposite? Is that?
Could be. Yeah. I mean, at the old course, I got to play it backwards. So I studied abroad in St. Andrews. So while I was there, I played it backwards, but in its history as a reversible course also, it would be played at various points in different ways. So at one point it was week to week, forwards 1 week, backwards another week. I mean, originally the reason that reversibility even exists is there was just one hole in a green and you'd play out to that hole and then back along the same path to the same hole. And then because it got busy enough that they needed multiple holes in a green, you'd play to one side or the other, one on the way out and the other on the way back.
Interesting.
And then you'd change it around on different days. So that's kind of where the whole idea came from. But at one point when the forwards routing became more prevalent, still in the winter, St. Andrews would do 1 month of reversible and the rest of the year as the conventional routing. And now eventually, and at a certain point, so many people are coming from so far to play the way that people play it in the open, that it became forwards all the time. But we'd probably do something where it's week to week or day to day, is my guess.
And so today at East Potomac, there's 36 holes. There's an 18 blue, there's a 9 white, which I play constantly. And then there's a 9 red, which is all par 3, which I actually just went out and played on Wednesday. How does your design affect those other two courses? Are those gone? Are they still there?
No. So the only thing that's happening that's kind of major to the way that the property is currently set up is that the last hole of the Walter Travis course would go through the portion of the driving range that's closest to the clubhouse. So the driving range would have to move in order to accommodate the historic recapture of the blue course. So that gives us some options about where the range could go. And some of this depends on approvals from the entities that can weigh in about what's acceptable architecturally out on East Potomac, and it's a historic place, so we'll have to go through the process. But our preferred thing to do would be to move the range into the space of the 7th, 8th, and 9th holes of the white course. And then move the white course to part of the driving range, as well as everything else that's not in the 7th, 8th, and 9th holes.
Okay.
So you'd be adding space that's not currently part of the white course, but also taking away space from the white course.
Yeah. So it'll still be there, but it sounds like it'd be a little bit of a smaller property.
Very slightly, not a ton of change. Plenty, you know, still the same length and types of holes and everything.
Got it. Okay, that's good.
But that's just the reality of trying to fit everything that, you know, currently exists on the property there in this future state, when there wasn't really a massive driving range back in the day when the whole thing was designed.
Yeah.
So.
and the red, that would...
The red course would maintain as a par three course of same length holes.
Really? So so the Walter Travis plan, the routing, doesn't touch where the...
Not red... really. Not not a ton. So the only thing that's changed over there is there's an additional parking lot in, you know, some of the original space over there, but...
Right next to the practice hole right there.
Right, yeah. So the practice holes would go away and be incorporated into the red course. Yeah. That's really all that happens.
Well, that's exciting. Hopefully we hopefully we can maybe stroll around there sometime. And then the third one is Langston. So Langston Golf Course on Benning Road, Northeast DC.
Yep.
Also just a ton of history. What's the plan there?
Sure. So from a golf course perspective, the plan at Langston is just to connect the golfer more to the site, which currently doesn't give you a view of what makes it special very often. Sure. But basically, it's part of the course is on an island in the river. All of the course, you should be able to see the river.
Yeah.
And yet you can't see the river very often at all when you're out there. So
we were just talking about this. Yeah. You know, there's at least three or four holes where you're on Kingman Correct. Island, and I played it a handful of times before even realizing yeah. that I was on an island.
In a lot of cases, what's blocking you from seeing the river is a whole bunch of invasive vegetation that's been allowed to go wild over time. And so it's in everyone's interest to, you know, clean that up and present an environment that is both better for the river, but also better for the golfer's connection visually to the river.
Got it. So would the routing change much there?
It wouldn't change a ton. What we'd be looking to do is kind of rebuild the driving range, improve the details of the golf course, but the routing itself wouldn't massively change.
Got it.
Just kind of taking more advantage of this of the river is really the key.
Sure. And so Langston's also, you know, very historically significant and well known, you know, being, you know, essentially at one point where most of the black golfers, African American golfers in the city would play. In large part because I might be need some help on the decades of the exact era, but they weren't allowed to play at East Potomac Park and
and
Rock Creek. Rock Creek, am I getting this right? Rock Creek and East Potomac at one point were essentially whites only, and Langston you could play. Is that
right? So this is a longer story than I will give it at this moment, but we could talk for a long time about the history of the DC courses in this respect. But when the East Potomac and Rock Creek courses were built in the early 20s. The golf courses were under kind of a DC government umbrella. Mm-hmm. Or more of a DC government umbrella than they are now, where they're federal. At that point, they were essentially segregated. There was a golf course specifically for African Americans on the grounds of the Lincoln Memorial. But as the area around the Lincoln Memorial was more and more heavily used over time, this is now getting into the late 20s and early 30s, mm-hmm. it was, I don't know whether it was untenable to continue the golf course there, but everyone kind of realized there needed to be another spot for, and this is in the context of that time, you know, where segregation was common, that there needed to be another spot for an African-American golf course because around the Lincoln Memorial didn't make sense anymore. And so there was a movement to build a course, you know, specifically for African-Americans, and that process occurred throughout most of the 30s. At the same time, they shut down the Lincoln Memorial course, so there was no place for African Americans to play. Mm-hmm. Around that same time in the late 20s, early 30s, and I'm not exactly sure on the dates either, the federal government took over control of all parkland in DC, including the golf courses. And this is, you know, by far kind of the coolest part of the story. They were much more dedicated to providing access to everyone to the DC golf courses than like the DC government was.
And when you say federal government, is this the National Park Service?
Well, it wasn't the Park Service, but it was the Department of Interior.
Okay, right.
And eventually that became the National Park Service. So it might as well be, but functionally that's what you're talking about, but I don't think it was named that at that time.
Did I get this right? And so the city leadership tried to take back control of the course to try to keep it whites only?
Right. So the federal government was protecting the right for everybody to play the golf courses regardless of race, and they were enforcing that with police to allow people of color to play East Potomac, at the same time that the DC government was trying to take the golf courses back from the federal from federal control through congressional action.
Yeah.
And in order to make the courses segregated again. So this is, the golf courses by no means were the only place where this fight was happening, but it was certainly a place that was very heated, and it's hard to imagine right now how just, open and hateful the process must have been for the African-American community who was threatened while playing East Potomac and otherwise intimidated at a time when they actually had the right to play there. And
some of this is well documented, and I encourage everybody to find this online. I'll share a link to it. But the National Park Service does a great kind of history of this.
Yeah.
On their website of the history of these golf courses, how it pertains to race.
Yeah.
And some of these stories of black golfers going to play East Potomac Park when they had every right to do so. Yeah. And getting harassed and fights breaking out and having to be protected. Going back to Langston, Langston today is, you go into the Langston Clubhouse and it is a history of African-American golf on the walls.
Yeah.
You go inside the clubhouse and it is predominantly African-Americans, whether they're playing or not. It's become a hangout, whether they're just, having their coffee, having their breakfast, chatting. So I certainly hope, and it sounds like that kind of spirit and that community for the black community of where it's located at Langston remains. And the amount of history at Langston, just look that up with Lee Elder used to run the course. Joe Lewis has played the course. Yeah.
There's a tree there named after Joe Lewis. It's funny.
Yeah, so obviously it sounds like, hopefully that's important to the National Park Service. Have you gotten
that? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, without a doubt. The Park Service is fantastic about understanding, documenting, and emphasizing the importance of history at the courses and the role it should play going forward. So this is something that is very high on, the list of things for a potential lessee to be, thinking about and making a part of the future plans for the courses. So that's, and that kind of brings back to I've said this before, but when it comes to East Potomac and changes at Rock Creek, from a golf architecture perspective, some of the things that have been done to those courses, which have, great histories for golf architecture, are kind of annoying. And, and the Park Service has been in place while a lot of that stuff has happened.
Sure.
And so it's easy to be kind of critical simply from that angle when thinking about the Park Service's role at the courses.
Sure.
But in a much more important and much broader context, the Park Service is the best thing that could have ever happened to these places because it's protected people's access to the courses. And that is much more important than any golf course feature or anything like that. And it just makes you, if we were to win the lease, it makes you really proud to be a part of that, lineage.
Yeah. That's interesting. And today these three courses, I've been playing these three courses, you've been playing these three courses for years and years and years, extremely diverse at all three courses.
Yep.
There's black, white, golfers out here all the time. Doesn't seem to be a majority of one or the other. However, golf in general, I think most people agree, still has a long way to go in that respect. And I think we saw some of that just with some professional golfers' postings on social media, over the past week. So we've got a long way to go. So that's good to hear your stance on it and National Park Service, making sure that that's certainly priority. And it comes back to National Link Trust talking about keeping everything accessible, and not excluding golfers, even if it's just from an economic standpoint, from playing these great golf courses that we have. The last thing I kind of skipped over that I'd love to kind of talk about before we ended here, so the RFP is coming up. You're expecting a decision in the next several weeks?
Yeah, and let's hope so.
But so one of the big pieces in your proposal, you brought in some power players into your proposal. Talk about that. Some architects, some golf course managers.
So out here at Rock Creek, we have Gil Hance and working on the design of the golf course, recapturing Flynn stuff, building the par 3 course. At East Potomac, we've got Tom Doak, who has several people who work for him, in addition to Tom's expertise, but who really care about Walter Travis and have done excellent job at places like Hollywood Golf Course in New Jersey, that are and Round Hill Club and several other North Jersey Country Club. There can't be anybody who's more of an expert in Walter Travis than Tom and his company. So they are in line to work at East Potomac, and then at Langston we've got Bo Welling, who's done a lot of great work as well, and can really help us recapture what makes that site special.
So I wasn't super familiar with Bo Welling. Yeah. I looked into it. Did he do a lot of work with Tiger Woods?
Yeah, so he works with Tiger Woods. Gotcha. I guess in an ideal world, we'd love to have Tiger be a part of the project as well, and we'll see if that happens. But there's no guarantee of that. But he is the designer for Tiger Woods Golf Design Company. And done a lot of great stuff on their projects. So I think it's set up really well for a good result at Langston.
Well, it's exciting. I mean, is rooting for the National Links Trust to win this proposal. We'll see what happens.
Thanks.
This has been great, Mike. I really appreciate you coming out, being one of my first guests.
Yeah.
I have a feeling if anybody actually listens to this thing or watches this thing, that we'll be doing this again.
Awesome. Love to.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
I got ideas. Johnny Wags' ideas. I don't have a good golf game, but I don't really care. I'm a regular dude living in D.C., and I want to know about D.C.-centric golf stuff. If you can tell me something that I don't already know, then that is great for me. I don't want the regular stuff. I want exciting stuff. I want different stuff. I want stuff I can't hear elsewhere. But I want it to be about DC golf.